So, this got me thinking. Because often I think of the Buddha's teachings as sort of, you know, instructions in meditation. Like, how does this affect my meditation practice? That's sort of always been my view, often, about what the Buddha teaches. And I realized that, wait a second, you can actually take all of the Buddha's teachings, theoretically at least, and focus them on relationship. What does it mean? What are the Buddha's teachings say about how to relate to one another? Let's make these teachings really practical, was the thought I had. And so, well, where should I start? Well, how about the Noble Eightfold Path? I mean, it's sort of the central teaching, right? So let's see how the Noble Eightfold Path relates to relationship. So that's the genesis of that talk. This talk is that thinking. So this is a wild experiment. I want you to, and hopefully it'll be an interesting experiment. It was for me to write this, so hopefully for you it'll be interesting to hear it. Basically, the thought is that all of life is practice. Practice isn't something you do, you know, sitting on your cushion once a day or for a long time in retreat or whatever. Practice is life. So if the Buddha's talking about practice, then let's apply that to relationship and see what happens. I want to start by reading something from the Samyutta Nikaya, which means the connected discourses of the Buddha. This is 45.2 for those of you taking notes about these sorts of things. So this is the Venerable Ananda approached the Blessed One. Having approached, he paid homage to the Blessed One, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Venerable Sir, this is half of the holy life, that is, good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship." "Not so, Ananda. Not so, Ananda. This is the entire holy life, Ananda. That is good friendship, good companionship, good comradeship. When a bhikkhu has a good friend, a good companion, a good comrade, it is expected that he will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path." It's a pretty clear instruction on relationship, I think. It's like, what the Buddha is saying is this right now, what we're doing here, we're in Sangha. This is really important. And if you think of relationship to others in that context, it can be quite interesting. So I think. So let's just take a look at the Noble Eightfold Path. I mean, here he's saying, cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. So let's do some cultivation here. And look at each step on the Noble Eightfold Path and how it relates to, interacts with, relating to other people. Right understanding, starting at the very beginning, right? Traditionally, right understanding refers to knowledge of the three factors, you know, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. Those are the things you start to see, to understand, not intellectually, but on some deeper level through practice. Well, what about the rest of my life when I'm not practicing? What about daily life? How do those things fit in? And I think that the main thing is that right understanding in terms of day-to-day relationship means understanding the importance of Sangha. Understanding how important it is to relate to others who are just like you on the path, who are practitioners, who are sincerely trying to change. This goes against the whole undercurrent of our culture, of course, which is, here we are, Colorado, right? Rugged individualism. I can do this by myself. I'm tough. You know? And we all know what happens when we do that. We get isolated more and more in our culture, getting more and more isolated by our devices, and more and less we're actually talking to people and spending time with people. And that sort of culture, that the mainstream culture, is a rejection of the idea of Sangha, of the importance of Sangha, of having a group of like-minded people who we support each other in our practice. But when we chant at the beginning, when we chanted, we took refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. The Sangha is refuge. The Sangha is this place we can go where we feel safe, where we can open our hearts to others and share what it is we're struggling with in our practice. Because if you're like me, you probably struggle sometimes. We all do. It's normal. And it's good to have others to share that with. And also just to have companionship that is wholesome. That isn't like, oh, let's all go to the bar and get drunk sort of companionship. We know where that goes, right? So right understanding is having Sangha with people of like mind. But what about impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self? I mean, that which are the key teachings of the Buddha in some ways. Well, let's think about the Sangha, for instance. Where does impermanence fit in here? Well, people come and go. You may have noticed that. If you've been here as long as I have, you've seen so many people come and they go and they're gone. Then maybe 2 years later they reappear and they're here for a while and then they're gone again. You know, it's like there's nothing permanent about this particular Sangha, this particular group of people, other than this Sangha has been going for 25 years. This group has been meeting regularly on Tuesday nights for 25 years. And this is just an extension of this Sangha that's been going on for 2,500 years. 2,500 years. Wow. I mean, I'm still not saying it's permanent, but it's pretty solid. And the impermanence is at the individual level, but at the Sangha level, there's a sort of a solidity and strength to it. Then, what about unsatisfactoriness? Going on our own is unsatisfactory. That idea that somehow I can figure this all out by myself and take care of myself, I'm tough. The Buddha was in Sangha for a long, long time before he went and sat underneath that Bodhi tree. He studied with two great teachers of his time, mastered what they had to teach, then he hung out in the forest with five other guys for 6 years. And then he went off on his own and practiced. Because he saw that the life as he was leading it as a prince, pretty nice being a prince, you think, was unsatisfactory. Sangha is what makes things satisfactory. The opposite of unsatisfactory. Not self. When you start to relate in terms of Sangha instead of just this me, Barry, but I'm this Sangha, you start to see how interconnected we all are. How that idea that of separate self starts to melt away in Sangha. We start to see how everything in the whole world, like what Thich Nhat Hanh calls interbeing, is what really is going on. That sense of separate self is illusory. That everyone is connected. Every being is connected. And we get a taste of that through Sangha. Through that constant connection we find over long periods of time practicing together. Okay. Right intention. Second. traditionally this implies a firm decision to go deeply into the practice, to understand the three factors. That's what right intention means. I'm going to actually seriously take up this practice. I'm going to practice on a regular basis. I'm going to whatever form your practice takes. So what about on this relational level I'm talking about? Well, it could be actually quite simple. It could be, I'm going to go to Tuesday night Sangha every Tuesday. Every Tuesday I can. I mean, there's going to be times. Your mother-in-law just came to visit and she doesn't want to go to Sangha, so you're not going to go to Sangha that night. That's okay. But in general, whenever I can, this becomes a priority. Whether it's this Tuesday night Sangha or some other Sangha, really doesn't make any difference. But you form a firm intention to relate to others in Sangha. And then make it the top priority in your list, or very near the top in your list of priorities of what you're going to do on a regular basis. Beyond that, it might be the intention to deepen your practice, to go on retreat, to do something a bit deeper, to go further into that connection with others. I can tell you that on my retreat experience, I've sat several long retreats, like month-long retreats, and you sit in the hall with 90 people. You don't know, maybe the names of one or two of them, but by the end of a month, you feel so close and connected to those people. You don't even know a lot of their faces. I sit at the back. I'm one of the rowdies in the back. So all I know is what the back of people's heads look like, right? I don't even know what... So it's like, that's your view of them, but there's like this sense of connection that I don't experience in any other way other than on retreat. And you get that even like on a day long or a few nights, when you go and you really feel the energy of that collective practice. It's something special. And so that having that intention to do something like that would be wholesome intention in terms of relationship, in terms of Sangha. To deepen your connection to Sangha through whatever practice. Whether it's that, or maybe you're going to go to two different nights, go Tuesday night and Thursday night. Lots of people do all kinds of different things. But to connect in that way. I have in bold at the bottom of this section. Intention implies action. So you can have lots of intentions to do things, but if you don't actually do them, it's not very useful. So right intention implies actually doing something about those intentions, whatever it is. Like Kalyanamitta group, all those different ways I talked about earlier on, all different things we can do, they're all ways to make connection to others, to connect to Sangha, to make connection, to have relationship with other people who are like mine. Really essential to the practice. Right speech, third step. Traditionally, this is looked at as making sure that you don't tell lies, that you speak the truth, that you don't speak harshly, that you don't gossip, and that you don't talk uselessly. Cocktail party chatter being a classic example of uselessly. All of these things, if you don't speak harshly, if you always tell the truth, if you speak softly, if you are never gossip, just makes for harmonious relationships. Think what it's like to be around someone who always tells the truth, always speaks softly, always avoids gossip at all costs. Never just babbles. Blah, 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 blah. What a relief it is to be around these people. To be, have that sense of safety, of refuge that they create. To be around those sort of people. It's really wonderful to have that sort of connection with people. Equally important, this is not often talked about in terms of right speech, but I think it's very important, is the opposite of right speech, and that's right listening, which is not very well practiced in our culture. It means really listening to someone, really like paying attention, making eye contact, focusing, not interrupting them, or as I catch myself doing, formulating what you're going to say in response to what they said, and they haven't finished saying it yet. You stop paying attention because you're figuring out some wise and witty thing you're going to say. Once again, this is a huge gift you can give another person. In terms of relationship, it's so important to be able to actually feel like you're being heard. And that you can give that to someone just by really listening to them, really connecting to them and taking it in. Ah, right action. I want to read something else from the sutta. This is this is from the Majjhima Nikaya 31. This is I came across this. Oh, what a great sutta. I like this one a lot. Basically, the Buddha has gone to hang out, essentially, with three bhikkhus who live together in this little compound. And he's sort of questioning them and how are things going, guys, sort of thing. I mean, doing his teacher job, right? And he's asking, he says, Buddha starts with, doesn't talk about your practice, says, how are you guys getting along? What's the social atmosphere here, right? And Venerable Sir, as to that, I think thus. There's a great gain for me that I am living with such companions in the holy life. I maintain bodily acts of loving kindness towards those venerable ones, both openly and privately. I maintain verbal acts of loving kindness towards them both, openly and privately. I maintain mental acts of loving kindness towards them, both openly and privately. I consider, why should I not set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do? Then I set aside what I wish to do and do what these venerable ones wish to do. We are different in body, Venerable Sir, but one in mind. And then the Buddha goes on and says, well, tell me more about just like your daily life. What's your day like? Venerable Sir, as to that, whichever of us returns first from the village with alms food, prepares the seats, sets out the water for drinking and for washing, and puts the refuse bucket in its place. Whichever of us returns last eats any food left over, if he wishes. Otherwise, he throws it away where there is no greenery or drops it into water where there is no life. He puts away the seats and the drinking water for washing. He puts away the refuse bucket after washing it, and he sweeps out the refectory. Whoever notices that the pots of water for drinking, washing, or the latrine are low or empty, takes care of them. If they are too heavy for him, he calls someone else by a signal of the hand, and they move it by joining hands. But because of this, we do not break out into speech. But every 5 days, we sit together all night discussing the Dhamma. That is how we abide diligent, ardent, and resolute. What struck me about this sutta is this is like just regular old daily life, right? It's not. They don't make a big deal out of who does the dishes and who's going to sweep out the hallway, and whoever's there when it needs to be done, they do it. This all gets taken care of without a big plan or figuring it out or making rules. They just do it. They relate to each other through loving kindness. There's a teacher named Stephen Gaskin, who, I don't know, this is my hippie past coming out here. So, Stephen Gaskin started something called The Farm in Tennessee in the late 60s, early 70s. It was a huge commune. It's still going on today. They do a lot of work for 12-step groups, and are very involved in birthing movements as well. Very interesting group of people. But I actually met Stephen Gaskin once, and he gave a talk. And he said something to me that, this is like 40 years ago, it's still stuck in my brain. The lowest form of cooperation is turn-taking. Taking turns, being organized, that's the lowest form of cooperation. Cooperation should just happen naturally out of loving kindness for each other without having to make it some rule and oh no, it's not my turn to do the dishes and all those dishes are there. You know, oh, there's a bunch of dishes there, or the dishwasher is full, someone's got to empty it, or whatever it is that's got to happen. I think dishes are not my favorite thing, and I do a lot of dishes anyway. And they just get done. That's part of relationship. That simple day-to-day little things that are so important, that's right action in terms of relationship. Just making sure that things just get taken care of. It's so simple. The beauty of the sutta, by the way, is that after this, the verses I read, then the bhikkhus describe how they go into deep states of meditation every day. Because they got no problems. They get along well. There's no interaction. Things are just taken care of. They have no problems in the physical world. They're interacting very nicely on the social level. They're supporting each other. So they can just practice. Interesting. Right livelihood. The fifth step on this path. First of all, I only want to say a couple of things about this. First one is the Buddha said that the ideal way to live, now this is 2,600 years ago, right? The ideal way to live is to either be a teacher or a farmer. Those are the two ideal professions, the two ideal ways to make your own livelihood, to teach or to be a farmer, to help other people through teaching or to feed them. Probably want to add a few more professions in this world. You know, nurses and doctors and those important things that have to get done. The other list that often is quoted when we talk about right livelihood is those things that what Buddha called the prohibited ways of making a livelihood. Making or selling weapons. Making or selling alcohol or drugs that cloud the mind and lead to heedlessness. Killing or harming other beings, and trading in slaves or owning slaves. Notice that all of these are about causing harm to others. All of these are harmful on a physical, direct level to others. Those are the ones that Buddha said, no, don't ever do these ones. Because they're the opposite of relating to others in a wholesome way. Right effort. This is where I think right effort really applies to relationship very clearly in my mind. The right effort has four parts traditionally when it's taught. The first is to avoid creating unwholesome mind states. So do what you can to not get into trouble. Do what you can to always consider the other person you're relating to when you're relating to them. How they'll feel and react before you say something or do something. You know, if you know it might upset them, why go there? Why go there? Even if, as we often do, we sort of justify what we're about to say or do by, but it's the right thing to do. Or they need to hear this. Or all those self-aggrandizing ways of thinking that we all get caught in. This doesn't mean, I want to be very clear here, this is the yellow warning flag part of what after what I just said. This doesn't mean that you should avoid difficult situations that sometimes arise in relationships. Bound to happen. Relationships always have difficult bumps in the road. Shouldn't avoid them, and you shouldn't ignore them. Just be careful how you approach the other person. Take them into consideration. Do it at a time when they're not, you know, they're all stressed out and rushing out the door and saying, "But I got to talk to you about something." Well, it's probably not a good time. You know, so choose your time correctly. Choose the setting correctly. Maybe make them a cup of tea first and then talk to them. You know, however you relate to these people. And when you do interact with them in this difficult situation, do it with a heart full of loving kindness. Not out of anger, not out of self-righteousness. Not because out of an attitude of superiority. Because that will just cause more trouble. So try and really have a heart full of loving kindness. See them as just another part of you that you're helping along the way. That you're no better than them, no worse than them. You're just equals sharing. Try and approach it from that place, and that'll be less likely to create unwholesomeness in the relationship. But there's another aspect of this. This is a great poem. As we go into this practice more and more, we're going to find that people we used to know, we're just not going to be so interested in hanging out with them anymore because of how whatever it is they do that we know. If I go hang out with those guys, I know exactly where I'm going to end up, and I don't want to go there anymore. This is advice on this topic. Naomi Shihab Nye, from her book Words Under the Words, called The Art of Disappearing. I love this poem. When they say, "Don't I know you?" say no. When they invite you to the party, remember what parties are like before answering. Someone telling you in a loud voice they once wrote a poem, greasy sausage balls on a paper plate, then reply. If they say, "We should get together," say, "Why?" It's not that you don't love them anymore. You're trying to remember something too important to forget. Trees, the monastery bell at twilight. Tell them you have a new project. It will never be finished. When someone recognizes you in a grocery store, nod briefly and become a cabbage. When someone you haven't seen in 10 years appears at the door, don't start singing him all your new songs. You will never catch up. Walk around feeling like a leaf. Know you could tumble any second. Then decide what to do with your time. It's a part of the practice, in a way. It's an interesting part of the practice because we're so attached to the social world. And sometimes we have to just go, "Yeah, I I'll turn into a cabbage instead. I don't know quite how you do that. But. Okay. So that's right effort. Yeah. Second step in right effort is do whatever you can to alleviate unwholesomeness once it has arisen. So, sure enough, sometimes in relationship to others, you or they or both of you do or say things that are, to be blunt, kind of stupid, unwholesome, foolish, downright hurtful sometimes, perhaps. It's just part of being a human being. It's not like you're bad. It's just you're being a human being, and sometimes you went off the rails a little bit, I guess you could say. First, in relationship with others, most important thing is to remember that you're not perfect and neither are they. Don't expect perfection in your relationships because it ain't ever gonna happen. Just don't even think that that might be true, that this person is perfect. Because they're gonna fall off their pedestal, sure as shooting. And if they think you're perfect, you're going to fall off your pedestal, sure as shooting. It's going to happen. You're human beings. So give up absolutely any idea of perfection. It's hard because it's like our whole culture talks about, you know, I looked across the room and there she was and I knew right away she was going to be my love forever and it's going to be perfect. And, you know, that's a whole movie script I just gave you right there, right? But that's our culture again has that sort of idea, that perfect relationship, whether it's with another, just one other person or with a group of people or whatever. Nothing's ever perfect. Too much change going on all the time. So what do you do? What is wholesome effort when you realize, I really put my foot in it this time, or my big mouth in it this time, or whatever. What do you do now? It's really simple, actually. Apologize and ask for forgiveness as soon as you can. Just apologize and ask for forgiveness. This is really hard to do because to do that, we have to admit that we did something wrong. That we messed up, which is really hard to do, to actually admit that. I messed up. It takes a lot of courage. But that's what you have to do. You have to actually ask for forgiveness. Apologize and ask for forgiveness. If you're on the other side of that equation, someone asks you forgiveness, give it right away. Don't hesitate. Remembering, here's another red, yellow warning flag. Remembering that forgiveness does not mean that what that other person said or did was okay. It just says, basically what forgiveness says is, my love for you is more important than what you said or did. My love for you is more important than whatever it is that happened back there. That's what's most important. No relationship, this is a categorical statement I'm making here, no relationship can last without forgiveness. Just period. No relationship can last without forgiveness. I speak from a 41-year marriage, so lots of experience in this area. It's absolutely essential to maintain relationship. Is to be able to forgive and to offer forgiveness. Both. Now we get to the third step. Do whatever you can to create a relationship where wholesome mind states can arise. Seems pretty obvious, but often we ignore it. We don't think about this. Just do things that you both enjoy. Do things that bring joy into your life, both of you. And sometimes that might mean, no, dear, you go do that, and I'll go do this. Don't live in each other's pockets. Don't expect your friend to always be there for you all the time. When you want to go to a ball game and they don't want to go, who knows why they don't want to go? But just go find someone else to go to the ball game with, or go to the ball game by yourself. Whatever it is we're talking about here. I'm a baseball fan, so I like the ball games. So you have to accept that we want to do things that we enjoy, that bring joy into our mutual lives, to help us stay connected. But at the same time, we have to give each other space to do other things that you're interested in and I'm not interested in, and vice versa. At the same time, here's another yellow warning flag. A lot of those in this one. That if the other person in the relationship is unhappy, there's nothing you can do to make them happy. That's a tough one to take in, but it's true. There's absolutely nothing you can do to make another person happy. The only person that can make another person happy is them. You can do things to create causes and conditions such that they might become happy. Bring them that cup of tea when they look kind of sad. Give them, watch their favorite TV show instead of your favorite TV show. Or whatever it is, just those little things, right, sometimes. Be someone that they can talk to and just really listen. But we can't take responsibility for someone else's unhappiness. It's hard not taking responsibility for our own unhappiness, let alone somebody else's. If they're unhappy, it's not your fault. It's a big one to bite on, but it's true. It's not your fault. And really believe that. And at the same time, stay positive and happy yourself as best you can. If joy is contagious. If you're happy and they're unhappy, your happiness is going to rub off on them, literally. It's going to make a difference because it's a contagious thing. Joy is like a wonderful disease. It just spreads out everywhere. Often that's the best thing you can do for someone who's unhappy, just to be happy. And let them feel that. Without rubbing it in their face, obviously. But just be happy. The fourth step in the right effort. If a wholesome mind state has arisen, do what you can to maintain it. If things are just great, if you have a relationship where everything is just great, we all have that with those times. Everything is just like, oh, this is so great. Do what you can to keep that going. Often what happens is we sort of, because it's so great, we think, oh, I don't have to do anything to maintain this. But it's like a relationship's like a garden. If you don't maintain the garden, pretty soon it's full of weeds. Or things don't get watered and they're falling over. Or whatever. There's lots of bugs in it. It's like you have to constantly sort of maintain that relationship. And it could be like just little things, but it's like something you have to consciously do. At the same time, here's my yellow warning flag. Don't ever expect it's always, well, this is great. It's always going to be great like this now. That's it. We finally found the secret to greatness in this relationship. It's going to be great forever now. Guaranteed, as they say, stuff is going to happen. Things are going to change. And the relationship will shift. And as you as the relationship shifts, that's where you put in effort to maintain it. Even though sometimes that relationship might be a little difficult. Because the love you have for that person is greater than anything else. That's the corollary to do what you can to maintain that relationship. Keep that joy and happiness going. Life has its ups and downs. This is the nature of life and relationship for that matter. So like this. Never a straight line. It's never always going to be the same. It's always going to change. Everything changes. Oh, back to impermanence. Here we go. That's the nature of life. Things change all the time. Finally, we get to right mindfulness and right concentration, the last two steps. I'm going to conflate these two. When we think of right mindfulness and right concentration, we usually think, this is where we really think, oh, this is now he's going to talk about meditation, right? He's going to talk about, you know, sitting together or something, which should, by the way, is a great thing to do if you have a partner who likes to sit together if you can. It's a wonderful thing to do. But to maintain wholesome relationships, mindfulness is the key. But to take care of those other six things we just talked about, mindfulness helps you do all of that. If I'm mindful, I'm less likely to do something that's going to cause an unwholesome mind state to arise. If I'm mindful, I'm more likely to see, oh, I probably shouldn't be saying that or doing that. If I'm mindful, if I'm concentrated, if I'm paying attention, then I stick to my earlier intention. I am more careful with my speech. I'm more careful with my actions. Mindfulness is the key to the whole thing. So mindfulness in daily life, just your day-to-day life, this is really an important part of the practice of living a life. Mindfulness ties it all together. It makes relationships more harmonious. I have one more poem to read, and then we'll have some time for discussion and comments. Some of you have heard me read this poem before. It's one of my favorite poems. It's from Dana Fald's book called Going In. And it's appropriately called Sangha. Teach me what I cannot learn alone. Let us share what we know and what we cannot fathom. Speak to me of mysteries and let us never lie to one another. May our fierce and tender longing fuel the fire in our souls. When we stand side by side, let us dare to focus our desire on the truth. May we be reminders, each for the other, that the path of transformation passes through the flames. To take one step is courageous. To stay on the path day after day, choosing the unknown and facing yet another fear, that is nothing short of grace. That's what we can give each other. That's what relationship is. Nothing short of grace. So that's all I've prepared. So now I want to, being a good member of the Sangha, give someone else a chance to talk besides me. So if you have comments, questions, thoughts, ideas, let it flow. It's really... this is part of being in Sangha, by the way, is actually sharing. This is letting people, making that connection that way is, I think, very useful in terms of creating Sangha. So don't be shy. No one, you're in a safe place. Remember, no one's going to laugh. Oh, what a crazy thing. Why is he saying that? That's really weird. They're just going to, oh, it's interesting that that person thinks that way. It's a wholesomeness that is here. Don't all speak at once, I think. Speak loudly. Yeah. It's more, not so much to avoid all people, but my point was I trying to make was that to choose what you do with your time, to choose who you spend time with. Often, you know, we have these habitual long-term relationships with people that they're going this way and I'm going this way, but we sort of somehow try and cling to that relationship because it's comforting. And that, I think, sometimes gets in the way of practice. And if practice becomes what's most important, which I think should be what we all do, then sometimes those relationships just end. And so it's not avoiding people, it's making conscious choices about what people you spend time with. In her case, it was pretty extreme. She's like avoiding everybody. She's a writer, right? You know, writers, hermits, right? Go off. I don't want to talk to anybody. I just want to go sit in my room and write. So, but in general, that's what she's saying. You know, especially at the end where she's saying, pretend you're a leaf falling from a tree, blowing in the wind. Now choose what you're going to do next. As opposed to just following along on your habitual paths. It seems more like what she's saying. Discernment is a very good word. Tell me more. Thank you. That's good. Other thoughts, comments? You're all dying to go home and see what happened to the Democratic debates. Nothing. I'll tell you now, nothing happens. There you go. We solved that problem. Questions? No questions, nothing. Okay. I thought you did a really good job, or such a bad job that you're all totally confused. I saw a hand waving in the back there, though. First of all, that's a very mindful statement you just made. So, which is good. And don't beat yourself up for the times when you're not. That's just doesn't do any good. We all mess up. I have to constantly remind myself, I messed up, and that's okay. I'm a human being. Human beings mess up sometimes, and that's okay. It's my latest mantra, actually, and that's okay. It's like I find myself, both in my sitting practice and in my daily life, using that as a reminder that to not beat myself up, to not judge myself. Go home 5 minutes early, and that's okay. Let's just dedicate the marriage. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.